Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston, CA. In late October, I attended an awards ceremony that honored a small group of rather exceptional people. The Carnegie Foundation and the Council for the Advancement and Support of Education had joined in citing a quartet of outstanding educators, teachers who had inspired students at schools ranging from small community colleges to mammoth research universities. I expected the speeches, the applause, and even the tasteful, elegant surroundings. What overwhelmed me was the powerful emotion of the event, a welling up of appreciation that moved everyone present, including me. Maybe that's because our best teachers are guides and friends for life, a part of us that we can always call upon for enlightenment and encouragement. One of the awardees that day was Vernon Burton, a professor of history at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Vernon, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you, George. It's always a pleasure to see you.
Vernon, likewise. I mentioned, of course, that you're a professor of history, and you certainly grew up in an historic period. Your native South was undergoing the dramatic changes of the Civil Rights Revolution. And I wonder if that revolution in any way inspired your interest in history and your wish to become a professor of history.
It inspired, I think, an interest in history. I didn't think about being a historian. I think I first noticed this in my small town of 96 South Carolina, a place that I love dearly and I love the people there. And I think I got so much good from that community. In fact, understanding what community is and how mutual obligation, things like that work. But it was a very different time. And in my church that I attended, it first struck me as someone who took fairly literally what my mother was teaching me about the Bible, about the church, that all people are the children of God, all are brothers and sisters. And in this rather time of change and transition, there were people who I'd grown up to respect very much who were saying things that if certain people of a different color came into the church, they would try to stop them. And I think this got me interested in race relations, and particularly the idea of people's value systems. Mm-hmm. In my case, the ideas of Protestantism and Christianity and how this played out in race and race relations. Mm-hmm. And I sort of studied that. I began to see history as a way to understand how people acted, and hopefully as a way that I personally believe that we can work to try to help people understand and create a better world. So I see history not just something to study because it's interesting to learn about the past, but it also helps us shape the future, hopefully in a better way.
I was, as I said earlier, moved, deeply moved by the entire ceremony, and in particular by the young student who introduced you, who had studied under you at the University of Illinois. She spoke very warmly of you, and what she said helps me further understand what you just said. She spoke about learning about Southern history from you. One of your techniques that she mentioned fascinated me. She said that in one of your classes, to illustrate points you wanted to make about Southern history, you took all the scenes from Gone with the Wind that used African-American characters, slaves, of course, and sort of ran them back to back. From that moment on, I wanted to ask you why you did that, what you wanted to achieve, and what, in fact, you did achieve with your students.
I think Gone with the Wind is a phenomenon, as a book, and then as a movie, it's a part of American culture. In fact, I use this in the context. I tell people that we pretty much went backwards from the 19th century. The most popular sort of entertainment book and show of the 19th century was Uncle Tom's Cabin, which most people don't read today, but which had a very different message about, in fact, the humanity of African Americans. It was an argument against slavery, and it was a very, in fact, in some ways a radical book. You might remember that Lincoln supposedly tells Harriet Beecher Stowe that she's the little woman who started this war that ends up ending slavery and moves us on the road toward a quest for equality. But it has a very different message. And then you get into 20th century America and you have Gone with the Wind, which captures the imagination of the nation, both North and South, and it's a very romantic picture. My own daughter, who's now a senior, is a good example of this. She was desperately in love with Clark Gable and the romance of Gone with the Wind. What people don't see in there is what I would refer to as perhaps institutional racism, or the way that we subtly, and not deliberately, I think, I'm not accusing the makers of Gone with the Wind deliberately doing this, but if you just see the movie, you get caught up in a love story and the war and all the romance of the film. But if you just take out scenes where African Americans presented both as slaves and then after the war, you note their depiction in certain ways. For instance, they're almost always presented with animals. And this even goes back to the Old South ideology of pro-slavery, which we're trying to argue that, in fact, did argue at least one element of it, of bestiality, relating African Americans as more toward animals than toward human. And students who see this, at least most of them, particularly white students, I think African American students sense this already, and maybe they haven't articulated why the movie bothers them, but get a whole different perspective of the film. And it's a way to get into how we have our own expectations, even today, that we expect within a university system some reason, instead of an African-American being the professor of history, we might expect them to be the custodian, and the sort of subtle things that work in. So that's one of the reasons I use that, as well as to get into a discussion of myth-making and of the South and how race relations have been created and create the sort of popular mediums in which they are presented.
You know, there's another thing you do, too, that I think is equally fascinating. Margaret Mitchell wrote Gone with the Wind. Many people know that. Mm-hmm. There's a woman, Margaret Walker, who wrote a book called Jubilee, which I don't think many people know about. You contrast the two of them.
That's right. I have students read the two. And, of course, one is an African-American writer. And to look at how the two of these writers approach the same subject. And, for instance, in Gone with the Wind, you discover that African Americans apparently have no families. You know, they basically are not taking care of African American children. But in Jubilee, you see a whole different story of the concerns there for their families. You discover the sort of dialect and how it's used in Gone with the Wind, which is absent in Jubilee, reinforces a sort of negative stereotype that's built into sort of the way we think about race in this country, and particularly in African Americans. So it's a good exercise to see how people treat the same subject from different perspectives. One is an African American writer and one is a white writer, and they're able to do a lot of different things in contrasting how the characters act, their feelings, that African Americans have lives of their own and they aren't some adjunct to the sort of white plantation, master, mistress, romanticism that we see, the sort of Magnolia and Mint Julep's myth of the South.
You know, I think the obvious question at this point, Vernon, probably in the minds of people listening, is Professor Burton does these kinds of extremely imaginative things to reveal truths, but what are you aiming for with the student? I mean, the ultimate purpose of this kind of instruction, with all that it implies, is something you want to bring forth clearly in the minds of these students. So what is that thing? What do you want them to become as a result of this?
I think the most important thing is to become critical thinkers. In some ways, I like to say that they're becoming historians. And it goes back to where we began, George, that to question whatever you read, whether it's the local newspaper or whether you hear me on this radio show, and to try to think in terms of why I'm saying these things, to think also in terms of different interpretations. It's very important for me to have students question interpretations of historians or of anyone, of Margaret Mitchell. And I in fact, make sure that they have conflicting interpretations, that they see that historians can look at this very same evidence and come up with totally different stories totally different understandings of what happened. And that's what's happening with Jubilee and Gone with the Wind. It's the same area of Georgia, same time period. One sees Reconstruction as I do, which was a extraordinary time of interracial democracy, one of the few times that America stood up and fought against racism, and the other sees Reconstruction as this horrible experiment, this tragic failure of the South. Mm-hmm. One sees the South as a South that is of blacks and whites, and the other sees a South defined as a white South. Mm-hmm. And these are just examples of how one looks at things and how scholars have used the same evidence to come to different interpretations. Now, these are novelists, so students can get into them earlier. But one of the exercises I have is students have to actually take one of my interpretations and argue against it, mm-hmm. and say that and come up with an alternative explanation to the one that I have. And I think that's a good exercise. It can be uncomfortable, but sometimes learning is uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. The one thing that really upsets me is that history is so exciting. We're all part of it. Everyone is an actor in history. They're not acted upon, every individual. And yet our history often leaves significant groups of people out, or at least has them acted upon and reacting to. And I think that it's important that people see that they are a part of this history. So that's one of the things I try to strive for, is this inclusiveness as well, to look for these stories that can give us sort of... I still believe in heroes in a rather old-fashioned virtue, not in the classic sense of the heroes. I am not a great fan of, say, the Robert E. Lees, the Stonewall Jackson, the Jefferson Davis, the men I like to fondly say that sort of turned the South prematurely gray. Now, that's a joke because of the Confederacy that no one ever gets in wearing gray. But the struggle in everyday life for people to make something of their lives, to make something for their families, to make something for their children, to make a better life, and for those who actually make a better world. Right. And that's probably partly my interest in the civil rights movement as I came up with it as well.
Let me take a moment from our conversation first to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest is Vernon Burton, professor of history at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and a recipient of this year's Professor of the Year Award. In the past, Vernon, certainly when you and I were coming up, teachers' aides were posters. They were things that were brought in from field trips themselves, that kind of thing. But today, teachers' aides, I would think, have to include computers and internets and software and all that kind of stuff. How do you make use of the internet, or do you?
Well, I do, George, but I want to say first, I think that a classroom and teaching is a very individualized and personal thing, and people should feel comfortable with what they do. So some of the greatest teachers will be those who will never use computers or multimedia. And so I don't think that you necessarily have to. What is happening is that this new generation of students, this is part of their lives. They come with it. The internet, of course, has opened up a whole new world. And I think we've talked about this offline before. I have a great fear and also great excitement. Computers and the internet can bring great democratization, my dream of democratizing education, democratizing access to information. It also can become a tool of a very select and elite group, and I hope that does not happen. And I think that's something we must guard against and work very hard, particularly those of us in the universities and research universities, to make sure that it does reach out to other people. University of Illinois is a land-grant institution. I think we have a special mission to reach out to people in all parts of the state, or all parts now with the internet, of the world.
Yeah.
And I can see it doing that. But students now have access to resources that they didn't have. And people who live in small towns, as I did, the town of 96, which I try to get to every moment that I can, because it's still where my mother lives and a large part of my heart and so many wonderful friends and people. But by the age of 12, I had read every book in the traveling bookmobile. I assume people know what the bookmobile is. It was like a little van that brought books from the nearest town that had a library, and you could check them out for that week and turn them back. And one of the things that's happening with the internet and the World Wide Web is the accessibility to not only books, but also to archival materials mm-hmm. and sources. The Library of Congress is doing a wonderful job. Right. The Smithsonian, a number of universities are putting things, as they say, online yeah. that give students an opportunity to look at primary sources, which I think are important. I guess we haven't gone there yet, and central to my teaching. Mm-hmm. I don't really call it teaching, but there's one class that I do that has 750 students. I don't feel I do well in it, but I'm told I do less worse than other people for whatever that's worth. It's very hard to get up in front of 750 students in an auditorium where there really isn't not even slide projectors or things that you can use. But I am convinced that in every class, students need to learn to work with primary documents, that is, original sources. And I have a little exercise that's worked well over the years where they use former slave narratives. And these were the WPA, the Works Project Administration, yes. interviews of individuals who had been born during slavery. And most of them are pretty old by now. It's the 1930s mm-hmm. when they're being interviewed and they're having an exercise. They sort of work through it. And it's a good exercise because whether it's an African-American doing the interviewing or a white and how people respond to it and what is an original source. But can you imagine what the librarian at the University of Illinois feels like when I have 750 students come tromping mm-hmm. in for this one source? Mm-hmm. Have I been able to take several interviews that I have them compare and contrast, scan them in, and put them on the web, and they can go and read them there? They can still go to the library yeah. if they want to, or they can print them off and use them.
But you know what occurs to me? This is an insight. I hope it's a faithful one. But Vernon Burton, what you're doing is you're taking the students and making them historians instantly. I mean, in other words, it's not that if you take this course and that course and 10 years from now you can be an historian. But I think what you're doing is saying, look, I want you to act like an historian, go to the primary sources, read combatively, contest me, but all these things at a very adult level. Is that right?
That's exactly right. I honestly think students need to be challenged. Mm-hmm. I think that students will rise to the challenge. And the goal, I guess you could say, is that I do try to make all my students historians. Mm-hmm. One student said I was trying to make them all junior historians. I don't like that term, because that's not true. I want you to be a historian in the truest sense. And
capital
to think
H.
as a historian, yeah. think critically, learn how to get to the sources and put a story together mm-hmm. With coherence and understand what evidence is and how much evidence you can also get from. So I think all of the things I do in the classroom are geared to training students to be historians.
I don't want to embarrass you, Vernon, but as you know, I love this work, first of all, and I love sitting here conversing with people like yourself each week who have done remarkable things. And because of that, I do try to prepare myself as much as I can. And so I went to a number of sources just to get ready for this conversation today. And here's the part that I hope doesn't embarrass you, but across the board, there are just numerous accolades for your personal qualities, for the kind of individual you are, from students, from peers, and from others. And a lot of it, particularly from students, has to do with your accessibility, your personal concern and interest in them. And so here's the question that comes from that. It's a philosophical question. For the man or the woman who wishes to be a good instructor at whatever level, how important is it, or is it important at all, that they are also, in addition to being teachers, moral models or people who reach out in a way that's much more embracing than just the classroom instruction?
That's a tough question, George. I know for me it's important, and I think it's really important. And in every classroom, I try to introduce ethical and moral issues because life deals with these things, and therefore history deals with them. And to not deal with them, whether it's the Civil War as a moral issue, we talked about racism, there's so many others, and ethical decisions that students need to be aware of. Because in life, if you aren't aware of them, you're making those decisions anyway. So I try to sort of point those out. And I think I'd be remiss not to try to live that sort of life is important to me. I'd hate to say that has to be for everyone else. I said, I think teaching's a very individualized thing. And I don't want people to think that sometimes the best teachers aren't necessarily the best storytellers. I do pretty well that way. But maybe the best teacher is someone who takes a student who can't write very well, never really gets to meet with a student, but reworks their paper over and over in solitude and returns that paper so that it teaches a student how to write. So there are all kinds of good teachings. I do certain things some way, but I don't want to take away from others. Part of why I put so much individual effort in it is that people did this for me all my life. My background was not one of the usual academic. And when I went to this small liberal arts school of Furman, professors reached down to someone who people thought spoke country words, funny words, but were willing to work with me to help me learn to write, to help me learn to think as a historian, or at least critically. And I feel like even in a large research university that I can bring some of that sense of caring and concern to students as well. And I try to do that. And I think it makes a difference. What amazes me is I don't do it for this reason, but how much more students respond to this, how much harder they're willing to work, how much more they're willing to read, how much more they're willing to write.
Well, let me add something, and how much longer they'll remember it. And I think the reason I have to say that is at the outset of the conversation, I spoke about being at the ceremony where you and three of your colleagues received this special award and being moved. And I'm a grown man, but I don't mind telling you my eyes were wet. I think one of the reasons was to see the four of you individually get the award made me mindful of my teachers. My parents were teachers also, and I clearly thought of them. But I think one of the things, Vernon, that must be a definition across the board of the excellent teacher, and you're right, there can be a variety of manners and people and methods, but they're clearly people that leave us as students with a lifelong sense that they cared about us in some kind of special way. There's a connection. In that ceremony, you may recall, the person who began it spoke about going around the world in individual conversations, hearing people say, "My teacher is," in present tense, even if that person was no longer alive. I was deeply struck by that, and I realized that I think it's true, that it is a presence that stays with you because of this connection.
Well, I agree, George. And I think one thing that is wonderful that the Case Foundation, what's the Council for the Advancement and Support of Education, the Carnegie Foundation are doing is valuing teaching, how important it is, and how desperate we are for people to become teachers and to become, as you said, I think, to a certain extent, role models, not just at the college level where I am teaching, but at all levels, and maybe even more crucial, in fact, at much earlier levels in students' lives. And I think our society has to learn to value education and teaching. I think it's clearly the hope for our society, as I said, as we move into a different kind of world. I mean, we've now moved from an industrial society, this post-industrial technological society. Education is even more important, and not just education so that people can program computers, but education so that our civilization, so that our moral and ethical values, so that those truths that transcend time, generations, hundreds of years, and technology can be discussed and talked about so that we can still value those things.
Amen. Well, actually, Vernon, that leads us to question that I was going to ask anyway, but now I think you provided the perfect foundation for it. Because I think what you've just said, like everything else, is extremely true and quite powerful. So the question is our society doing enough or doing the right things to bring people forward, particularly, well, actually at both ends of the spectrum, young and older people, into the profession of teaching?
I really don't think so. I think we've made some strides. I must say that AmeriCorps I've been very pleased with. But until our society says that we are willing to, you know, this is the old saying from someone like me who grew up in the church and still a person of faith, is, you know, you show what you value by where you put your money, particularly when the future wants you to tithe. They'll right. mention that. But the same thing as our education. Until we're willing to say we are going to pay the people who teach in our children at ages 5 through 16, 17, 18, to pay them, because they're the ones who are so influencing outside of the parents, the values and what they're learning, what they're worth, what is that worth to us, then we've got a long way to go, George. What I'm amazed at is the teachers that do it because they care so much. I mean, the people who are teaching, most of them could do almost anything else and get a lot more money. Now, I don't think they'll get the satisfaction. That's what we get, a special kind of satisfaction. So what you have is an extraordinary group of dedicated people. My own daughter taught for 5 years right here in inner city Washington, D.C. So I got a little bit of firsthand what really tough teaching was, really doing God's work, I think, in there. And it's just extraordinary, the demands on the people. The rewards are not the financial ones, because they are not what they should be. And I think that's something we've got to address. And I think more now than ever before, or we're going to have a different kind of society, a society of haves and have-nots like we've never seen, as people will put children in private schools, those that can afford it. So I don't want to sound too pessimistic, because at the same time you see people just totally dedicated and putting their lives there to help make better citizens.
Right.
And that's part of what teaching is as well, is a school for citizenship.
Exactly.
And I don't mean brainwashing. I mean training people to be critical thinkers so they can be better citizens and make democracy work.
You know, for all the above reasons, Vernon, and the way you concluded, to make democracy work, and because teachers, just in the course of what they're doing, are giving us a sense of citizenship as well, I think it's in our national interest. I think that's what you're really telling us. Society has to back these dedicated people up. We'd better start doing that to the greatest degree possible. It's a wonderful message.
Well, I really think it's crucial, too. One other thing, George, that I'd like to see, I've thought about, I mentioned land-grant colleges. It seems to me that someone needs to come forward with a bold plan, sort of like the land-grant colleges when they were put in years ago, and say that every single student should be able to go on to college if they are academically able, that no one, because of finances, should have to be held back, that economics should not be the reason someone doesn't get to continue their school. And I think that some political leader needs to look at this and say it's time for this kind of bold initiative to say that we are never going to make economics the basis of who gets to go forward on into education, who gets to continue their education, but it will be of anyone who wants to and is able to, in terms of academics, by working hard, will have that opportunity to do so. So I think there's a lot can be done in this country to put education where it should be. And I think I don't think that's a pie in the sky dream. I think that could be done very easily with some rearranging some priorities.
Vernon, I'm delighted with that. Because that's specific, that is a proposal. I think it's of major importance. It strikes me that we're being heard in the year 2000. This is a presidential election year, and I hope what you've just said is heard loud and remembered, because it should be on our national agenda. Vernon Burton, for that, for so much else, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, George. It's always so much fun and a pleasure to talk with you.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest was Vernon Burton. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Karen Reed. Our technical director is John Tyler. And production assistants are Kirsten LaCour-DeBelko and Andrea Bertone. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For cassettes or more information on Dialogue, call us at 303-823-8000. Contact us on America Online at Radio Dial. That's RADIODIAL at AOL.com. Visit our internet webpage at www.ics.si.edu.